The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. And now and then we'll dip into our Book Nook archive and pull out a recording of an interview that I did some time ago and bring that back to the airwaves. And this is one that we haven't had back on for many years. It was recorded back in 2003. And now and then I get lucky and I get a poet on the program. And on this particular day in 2003, I had a poet who came through the area. She was originally from the Cincinnati area, and she's a very famous person. Her name is Nikki Giovanni, and she had just published a collection of poetry called Quilting the Black-Eyed Pea, and she came out to Yellow Springs because she was doing a book signing in Dayton that night. And this was the first and only time I've ever had an opportunity to interview Nikki Giovanni, and I loved our conversation that day. We're going to revisit a portion of that interview this morning on the Best of the Book Nook, going back 17 years to Nikki Giovanni talking about Quilting the Black-Eyed Pea. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Nikki Giovanni to the program today. Welcome to Yellow Springs.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
This is sort of a homecoming for you. We're about 60 miles north of where you grew up.
Absolutely, yeah. I grew up in Lincoln Heights. You know, we always say Cincinnati, but I'm actually from Lincoln Heights. And we used to come up to Yellow Springs, play tennis. Yeah. I had friends at Antioch, you know, when I was not a little girl, but much younger. Yeah. And, of course, my good friend Virginia Hamilton was from Yellow Springs. We miss Jenny a lot and certainly send a lot of love out to Arnold.
Well, she has sat right where you're sitting, and we all miss her.
Oh, yeah.
Nikki, how many books is it now?
I think this is the 14th book of poetry, and there are a couple of essays and some children's books. But yeah.
Well, I was so delighted to read your poetry because you're always so topical.
Thank you.
And as I was reading it, you never shy away from talking about what's on your mind. And you have a poem in there about September 11th. And I read it and I thought, you know, she really cares about those dogs and cats that nobody came home for them.
Sure. Yeah, that was my first thought. Because nobody thought, you know, we thought about the humans. Because humans do that. It's such an unattractive quality of the species. But nobody thought, you know, who's going to tell the dogs, especially the dogs, because cats are a little more independent. But who's going to tell the dogs at 6 o'clock your master's not coming back, that nobody's coming back? And I think all of us were concerned. There was the animal lovers did do an excellent job, you know, in terms of trying to get to places and opening doors and things. But you know, some animals died and some animals were afraid. You know, not just the animals in immediate ground floor. But, of course, cats are very hard because cats are so capable. You know, and if a cat got out, you know, the cat's looking for its person and the person isn't there. So, no, that and the old people, I really worried. And I still worry about the old people because we don't chart it because nobody wants to follow that. But I'm sure that many people who were living with their grandparents or their grandmothers would be mostly the case, who now their grandmothers, they're alone, having to eat alone. It's not that they don't have money. It's that they don't have anybody. And so the neighborhoods need to step up. And I think New York, I mean, of all the cities, New York is going to be the city that does that best. I have a lot of love for New York. I live there. And in my heart, I think of myself, you know, even though I'm actually an Appalachian, I was born in Knoxville, grew up in Lincoln Heights here in Cincinnati area. But New York is a great city, and so I think New York responded very well. But there's still holes, you know, and nobody wants to put their money into making some of these human concerns a little better, yeah.
I sometimes will go onto the internet the night before I interview somebody, and I'll put in their name just to see how many hits I get. And I think I had about 75,000 on you.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you've been around for a while. How did you get into this poetry thing?
Well, I was in college. I'm of the age that you always wrote. So I went to school, Oak Avenue School, and my kindergarten teacher was Willa Hicks, you know. And we didn't write for Miss Hicks, but we surely did write for Miss Scott, my first grade teacher. You started writing then. So it wasn't unusual. I'm not going to put myself in the position of saying that segregated education was a good education, because segregation, I agree with the Supreme Court, is wrong. But we were in a small school, and we got a lot of attention. There were few of us. I think in my first grade class, there were maybe 8 of us, something like that. And so, of course, you got a lot of attention. And I've always liked stories. My mother's a great storyteller, and my grandfather was a great storyteller. That whole side of the family, the Watson side of the families, were always enjoying storytelling. So you grew up hearing stories, and you grew up hearing the myths and, you know, the history. And writing is something that didn't come naturally, but it was certainly something that interested me. So by the time I got to college, I was thinking, boy, that's wouldn't it be nice to be a writer? And, of course, everybody tells you, and you learn not to listen to people, of course, but everybody tells you, you know, you can't earn a living. And I thought, well, why can't I earn a living? You know, maybe I couldn't earn a living only because my living was out of proportion to what I could earn. And so I decided to put the horse before the cart, because so many people put the cart first. And I figured if I'm not in debt for, you know, things I don't want, if I'm not, you know, trying to buy the latest car or the latest clothes, I probably could earn a living. And it's only going to be a failure in that there are other people, my contemporaries who I graduated from school and they're all out making $30,000 a year, something crazy, thinking they're doing well. And I was dating a guy, and it was really funny. I was laughing about it recently. I was dating a guy. His name is Alvin. And we were talking one night. We were on the phone, you know. I was in the dorm. We were talking. He was like, what are you going to do after graduation? I said, I think I'd like to write. And Alvin said, oh, everybody wants to do that. And I heard him. I really did. I heard him. And I thought, now, one of us is crazy. And if I'm listening to Alvin, it has to be me. So whatever we were talking about, our friend Tom Dooley and stuff, Tom was a guy in Atlanta, and he was Tom wanted to write, and I said, that's good. And, you know, we just finished. And I hung up, and I said, you know, I'm not going to talk to Alvin anymore because he's going to depress me. And he was supposed to be my friend. So when I said that, he was supposed to say, that's a good idea. And I try to be a good friend, and I know what a good friend is. And I thought, let me get rid of this man before he ruins my life. And so I did. I did go on to write, too.
A number of names come up in the poems in this book, and they come up over and over again. One is Gwendolyn Brooks. Another is Emmett Till.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, Emmett Till, you know, Emmett's mother just died in December. In early January, and that's such a loss. But for 47 years, she kept her son and the sacrifice that she and her son made, because he, of course, died a horrible death, but she also had to lose her only child. And people say that, but, you know, it's not like if she'd had 5 more, it wouldn't have hurt, because anytime you lose a child. And Emmett Till, for my generation, is certainly the linchpin. And I'm saying my generation will include Rosa Parks in that. Emmett Till was murdered in August, and 10 weeks later, Rosa Parks said no. And, of course, from Mrs. Mobley, we get the wonderful issues, Emmett Till, Bradley Mobley. And from Mrs. Mobley, we get that wonderful statement, which comes up a lot in my work and has always, I want the world to see what they did to my boy. And opening that casket was key to a lot of things, because if the sheriff had had his way, the body would have been buried in Mississippi, and they would have pretended that Emmett was alive someplace. And so she did work it with the Pullman porters, who stopped the northbound train to put the body on the train. And, of course, they kept him in their personal effects, not in baggage, because at any point that body had been discovered, it would have meant probably the death of all of them. And got Emmett home to Chicago, where she opened it. He lay in state for 4 days. And the undertaker said, I don't think I can I don't think I can make him presentable. And she said, no, don't. You know, I want the world to see. And as she said in an interview shortly before her own death, she said, I just wanted everybody to see what I saw, because it was barbaric, and it was worse than anybody could take. This is just a 14-year-old boy, and everybody tried. I've been very upset with many of the so-called interpretations or the books about Emmett, because they always want to make the Till figure older and more knowledgeable and more sophisticated. It's just a 14-year-old boy. And the comparison would be about 8 or 9 years ago, the Wilding case in New York, where they arrested those six or seven, I really forget right now which ones, young men, 14, 15-year-old, on a rape charge. And I remember seeing that as like, wait a minute. You know, my son is 33 now, but I had a kid who was a 14, 15-year-old. They're not sexually viable. And everybody, I know men like to say it, you know, the men like, oh, yeah, my boy's been screwing since he was 12. But none of that's true. And, you know, you looked at those little 14-year-olds, it's a Scottsboro case. And you think to yourself, my God. Well, they put the boys in jail. They railroaded them. They interviewed them without their lawyers or their parents around. They forced confessions out of them, which is not hard to do with a 14 or 15-year-old boy. The boys go to prison. They've been raped. They've been beaten. And God only knows what they have experienced. They're coming out. They're out. And, of course, they ran the DNA and found out, oh, no, they didn't do it. Oh, we're sorry. We made a mistake. You know, it's not right, you know.
And Gwendolyn Brooks.
Oh, Gwen is my friend. Now, I met Gwendolyn Brooks at Fisk University. She came down for a writer's conference. But, of course, I'm just the groupie carrying her around and taking her to dinner and things of that nature. And I didn't really have any reason to think that Miss Brooks remembered me, because you meet a lot of people, you know, so that's fine. But when I finally did get to New York, I attended Columbia University. Well, I attended Penn first, and I was not going to be a good social worker. Hmm. And Louise Shoemaker, who was a sweetheart, helped me get a scholarship to go to Columbia, where I enrolled in the MFA program. And I did get it out. I got my book out. My book went on. And so it's like it goes on, right? And I picked up a paper, and I don't know if there's Times or what, and it was saying, you know, they were castigating us, is term, Gwendolyn Brooks, for having a writer's workshop with the Blackstone Nation. Now, Gwen lived on the South Side, for those of us who know Chicago. She lives on South Evans, right? Blackstone Nation is right there. And so she started a workshop with what they call these gangs, and why is she doing that? You know, a Pulitzer Prize winner, why is she doing that? I thought it was cool. And so I called Gwen, because I just thought, well, I've always wanted to be with the people. I wrote a poem about that. I've always wanted to be with the people running rather than the people chasing. And so I said to myself, I wonder if she's listed, because at that point I was listed. And because, you know, I did not be listed for the longest, and then finally people call you in the middle of the night and stuff, you have to not. But she was listed. And I called and I said, hi, I'm Nikki Giovanni. I write poetry. I've had a couple of articles in the Negro, because I thought, you know, there's no way this woman's going to remember me in the Negro Digest. You know, she said, I know who you are. And I said, well, thank you. I was in your program with the Blackstone Rangers. And I just wondered, you know, if you'd like somebody to come with you. I'm so enamored of what you're doing. I think it's such a good idea. And I don't like what people are saying. And if you want somebody, you know, to stand with you, I'd love to come to Chicago and go to workshop with you. She said, you would? I said, yeah, I would. And she said, well, we meet, you know. I said, I'll be there. You know, it's no problem at all. I never could get around to Chicago, so it always makes me feel really bad. So I had to have a car. I called my publisher. I said, I'm paying for the trip to Chicago, but I have to have a limousine. Well, it was a town car, you know. I have to have a car, because if I was driving, I'd still be looking for Gwen. But I went, and I met the Blackstone Rangers, and they were nice young men. I mean, you know, everybody was having a fit, all their killers, you know, the same way they do now. And I thought, you know, no, they're just nice young men trying to find a way to exist, a way to live, a place to be. And so I was very glad to do that. And Gwen then said, you know, well, why don't you come home and have dinner before you go back? Because that's in the days that you could catch a flight from Chicago to New York every hour on the hour. And I said, I'd be, you know, really pleased. I mean, I was totally thrilled. It's Gwendolyn Brooks. I didn't know she couldn't cook. And, oh, man, I mean, she is the worst cook of all. And so we went back to her house, you know, and she's pulling things out and she's cooking. I'm thinking, because I'm a good cook. And it's like, oh, my God. And so in all of the years that I knew Gwen, I never made that mistake again. Every time I was in Chicago or she was in New York, I took her out. Mm-hmm. And even the last time I saw her, she was like, you know, she wasn't feeling well. And I said, why don't we go out and have a steak or something, you know, because she liked it. And she said, well, I'm not really feeling well. Maybe we'll have dessert. I said, I'll bring it. She said, I can make some. I said, no, we can't have you making dessert. So she had moved over to Chicago, to the it's not Chicago Beach, but the big apartment. So we went over, and actually it was, I'm simply sharing this because Gwen was never really a sports fan, but it was the night that Seattle was playing the Bulls, mm-hmm. and it was the sixth game. And so I was there, and I had bought some pastry and stuff. And I said, you know, Gwen, why don't we turn on the game? Because we were sitting there talking about, why don't we turn on the game? And she said, is that Michael? Because she's that, you know. I said, yeah, but we can't cheer for Michael. I said, we're cheering for Seattle. She said, I don't think I can cheer against Michael. I have to live here. I said, well, if you cheer for Seattle, right, and Seattle wins, we'll get another game. She said, and then I can cheer for Michael. I said, then you can cheer for Michael. But let's cheer tonight. Because I'm just, you know, she has a daughter, but her daughter doesn't treat her like that. I said, let's cheer tonight for Seattle. And she said, okay, well, what we do, because we're just having fun now. I said, now, anytime Michael gets the ball, you're going to notice that the crowd is going to say, Michael, Michael. She said, well, what are they doing? I said, they're taunting him. So we're going to say, Michael. We were doing it. Mr. Blakely walked in. They've been married forever, right? And we're going, Michael. And he said, Nikki, how did you get my wife to watch a game, let alone cheer? I said, she likes me better than she likes you.
Oh, wow.
Speaking of food, I got really hungry reading your meatloaf recipe.
You know, meatloaf, I didn't realize. I guess I'm going to eventually have to do the food, the gourmet poet or something like that. Because I hadn't really realized until somebody else brought it to my attention how frequently food comes up in my poems. But, of course, meatloaf is it's so down to earth. It's an exercise. I wrote that actually with my students. It's an exercise I ask my students to do. You know, give me your recipe for meatloaf. You always have the kid that says, I don't eat meat. You know, you just want to strangle them because you know right away, and if you would be in a bad mood, which I'm usually not, you know, you would flunk them because they missed the point. The point is not do you eat meat. The point is what do you turn to when you need comfort, right? And so all of the kids that immediately turn into that, you know, okay, these kids I can work with. I used to also do a thing called what do you have for breakfast, you know? And so the kids that would come in and say, oh, I had a cup of coffee and stuff, you know, and you know, like, oh, boy, we got a mind not going here. And then I'd have other kids that come in and say, well, today I really wanted ostrich eggs. And so I got in, you know, and that's because it's all in the fun, you know, in the fun of it. I think we, and that's a whole nother drift to all of this. I think we rob so many of our children of imagination. And parents say stupid things like, you know, she lies all the time. And I'm listening to this 5-year-old saying, you know, well, yesterday when I went to the park, you know, oh, she's always lying. And I'm thinking, you know, she has imagination. She's not lying. You know, the lying is, no, mother, I didn't eat the cake. You know what I'm saying? It makes you crazy. Meatloaf is important because it's I mentioned meatloaf, I think, at least twice prominently. And the other time is in the title poem, Quilting the Black Eyed Pea, We're Going to Mars. And as NASA is asking Black America, what should we do? One is that you need meatloaf. I mean, how can you go that far without meatloaf? And you put it in that little oven they have up there, you know, because they're not on the shuttle now, and I'm heartbroken about Columbia. And it was old and probably should have been retired about 5 years ago. So it had been on borrowed time for a while. So I'm not the American that's going to say, oh, gosh, you know, we can't go back up there. You know, said we lost 7 people. I live off of I-81. On any given weekend, we lose that many because the trucks run into the cars. And I'm not casual about anybody's death. You just have to take my word for that. But we certainly cannot stop exploring the heavens because of this tragedy. We don't stop doing anything else. We don't stop flying. We don't stop trains. We don't stop cars. We don't even think about stopping cars, bicyclists, anything else. All deaths are diminishing, and all deaths are sad. And I would mourn all deaths. I would mourn the Columbia deaths as much as I would mourn anybody on death row at this point, because it's all a diminishment, and you wish that there was some other way that we could handle. You know, we wish that it didn't have to be. But I don't see any difference between what happened with Columbia and what the former governor, certainly of Texas, George Bush, did in executing the most people in the United States. I think that's shameful and disgraceful, because that's to no good end. That's about craziness. At least the Columbia people were trying to discover new knowledge. At least they had been to the heavens. At least they were about something. Bush's execution, like his wars, are diminishing for no good reason.
My guest is Nikki Giovanni, and I read that poem out loud last night, Quilting the Black-Eyed Pea, and it seems that as time passes, poems take on whole new meanings, and that one surely has in the last week.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the death penalty, and just in the last week we see Attorney General John Ashcroft intervening and trying to make the death penalty happen in cases where there's been plea bargains. I'm sure you're aware of this.
I try not to look at George Bush's stupid face, and I try to avoid reading anything about Ashcroft, because what I'm always informed of is that Ashcroft was defeated by a dead man that everybody knew was dead. What does this tell us?
Well, it tells us they liked Mel Carnahan, for one thing, doesn't it? Isn't he the one that lost to Gene Carnahan?
He's the one that lost to a dead man. Let me dig. And everybody knew the man was dead. It wasn't like the man died yesterday and nobody was sure. Everybody knew his opponent was dead, mm-hmm. and they said, we'd rather have a dead man than you. But you know what I don't like about the right? I mean, there's a lot of things. But I don't understand why these people are anti-abortion and pro-capital punishment. And I don't know why they don't get called on that. How can you be anti-abortion? You know, life is sacred. Life begins at erection, you know, not even penetration. And then you turn around, what, I'm supposed to have the kids so that you can kill them? What kind of sense does that make? You know, there has to be some, either I have the right to abort and you have a right to kill what I don't, or I am being compelled to have it, and I'm not going to let you kill it. How can you be for anti-abortion? Let me put it in. How can you be anti-abortion and pro-capital punishment? I don't understand that. And I don't understand how they get away with that. So, if life is sacred, you understand? If life is sacred, then what makes it less sacred? And I think the United States has to have more people on death row, despite Governor Ryan's best efforts. And I'm really proud of Governor Ryan, because somebody needed to take that step. You know, it needs to stop. And I don't know any – there's no first world country that's anywhere near with the people in prison that we have. And I think, you know, we got China there, maybe, or South Africa. I mean, it has to be something that's very unattractive. Mm-hmm. To have this many people on death row. And, of course, Illinois is getting ready to – it's like, okay, we can't do anything about what Ryan did, but we can start all over again. We got a 22-year-old. We're getting ready to put him on death row. That's so crazy. It's so 15th century, you know. Next thing you know, we'll be, you know, torturing the mentally ill and you know, beating, whipping people in public square because they have hunchbacks or because they have tumors or something. What kind of sense does that make?
We'd love to hear a poem.
Oh, sure. You know, absolutely. I'm going to read a poem because this is a poem. I'm always laughing because Oprah Winfrey doesn't like me. And I'm always laughing. She doesn't, and I don't like her. So it's very mutual. Idiot. And but I got to tell you, I have a minute. I mean, are you on? See, what happens, a couple of years ago, a skater named Tanya Harding had a boyfriend named Jeff Galuli who attacked a girl named Nancy Kerrigan. Mm-hmm. And Nancy Kerrigan, Jeff was arrested. Glulie was arrested. And I thought, as well as other people, I was not the first person to raise that issue. Well, what part did Tonya Harding play in this, you know? And everybody said, oh, Tonya didn't have anything to do with it. And so I was on a show like this, you know, and I was like, that's ridiculous that Tonya didn't have anything to do with it. Jeff Galuli is nothing but a white Stedman, you know? And can you imagine Stedman doing something without Oprah and, you know, telling him what to do? And, of course, she took exception to that. She has no sense of humor, which goes to show you money can ruin you. This is a poem because Gail King invited me to participate with them. O Magazine put O.D. Magazine, did the body. And they called me and said, you know, would you like to write something on the body? And I said, you know, which body? And it's like anybody. I said, fine. Because somebody had the hair and they were telling you what was already. Somebody had the skin, the eyes and things like that. And I said, well, I want the feet. I hope nobody has the feet. And they said, no, nobody has the feet. So I did. I really thought that they were just going to reject it and go, yeah, yeah, you know, sort of get back at me. But they printed it. And Gail's good people. It's called The Song of the Feet. It's appropriate that I sing The Song of the Feet. The weight of the body and what the body chooses to bear fall on me. I trampled the American wilderness, forged frontier trails, outran the mob in Tulsa, got caught in Philadelphia, and am still unreparated. I soldiered on in Korea, jungled through Vietnam, sweated out Desert Storm, caved my way through Afghanistan, tunneled the World Trade Center, and on the worst day of my life, walked behind JFK, shouldered MLK, stood embracing Sister Betty. I wiggle my toes in the sands of time, trusting the touch that controls my motion, basking in the warmth of the embrace Days Inn offers with warm, salty water. It is appropriate that I sing the praise of the feet. I am a black woman.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling. And that was a poem being read by Nikki Giovanni from her collection, Quilting the Black Eyed Pea. And that was recorded 17 years ago. She came out to see us here in Yellow Springs back in 2003. She was on book tour, and it was a homecoming in a way because she grew up in the Cincinnati area. And as she mentioned during that interview, she used to come out to Yellow Springs to play tennis back in the day. And she was friends with the late Virginia Hamilton and her husband, the poet Arnold Adolph. And Nikki, after she read that poem, got into the subject of reparations and how paying reparations to the descendants of people in this country who had forebears who had been enslaved would be good for the economy. And it was quite an interesting discussion that we had about that. And I will bring you another segment from that interview sometime in the future on the Best of the Book Nook, and I'll try to include that part about reparations because it really made sense to me at the time when she talked about it. She talked about what a jolt that would be for the economy if all these people suddenly had $20,000 or $30,000 that they wanted to spend, and just what that would do for people and their lives. You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. If you go to our website at wyso.org and click on the Book Nook pages, there are over 600 podcasts of interviews that we've had on the program. You can listen to them at your leisure. Lots of listening for you right there at wyso.org. Thanks, as always, for tuning in for the Best of the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.